This is a Glass Box Media podcast.
Lauren.
Mike.
So we host a podcast for Wired called Gadget Lab.
We do.
We do.
Yes, that is correct.
Tell the good people some more about it.
Well, I think the good people should definitely tune in every week because they get to hear me roasting you.
Hey, now.
All right. No, really, what Gadget Lab is Mike and I tackling the biggest questions in the world of technology. I like to think of it as the best of Wired's journalism, but in audio form. We cover the big news of the week in techland, but we also offer our expert analyses and opinions on all things consumer tech, whether that's mobile apps, hardware, startups, cryptocurrency. Mike, what's been a recent highlight episode for you?
We did a deep dive on the group behind the massive Okta hack. Mm-hmm. We also had a great conversation about Web3 and the metaverse. What stands out for you?
Never metaverse you didn't like. I really enjoyed our recent podcast about Peloton. And recently, the legendary tech journalist Kara Swisher joined us to talk all about Elon Musk and the future of Twitter. So I guess we should tell people how they can listen to our pod.
We release a new episode of Gadget Lab every week, and you can listen and follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you pod.
Today on Around the Coin, I interview Alex Vilhelmina, the CEO and founder of Plug Pagamentos, or Plug. Alex and Plug went through YC, and they raised a few million dollars. They've been around for a few years. They're building a Latin America payments platform. Alex has 12 years experience traveling around the world, selling payment services like Braintree into local payment providers and merchants. So we talked about what they're doing specifically at Plug in Latin America, what their approach is in Brazil, the landscape of the payments industry in Brazil, the comparison between different Latin American countries, and much more. Alex is incredibly knowledgeable about the payment space, and I hope you find this conversation as enjoyable as I did. So without further ado, here is Alex Vilhelmina. All right, Alex, I'm excited to be talking with you live. Thanks for hopping on today. I'm really excited about your company. It's pretty unique in the sense that you're solving a payments problem outside the US, namely in Brazil. You're in Rio now. You went through YC and you raised a couple of million dollars fairly recently. Where were you when you came up with this concept, or what was the spark for solving this problem?
Yeah. And likewise, thank you. Thank you for having me, Mike. So I worked previously at Braintree, which for those who don't know, it's a PayPal company. And I managed a few markets for them, mainly in Southern Europe. So Portugal, Italy, Spain, and parts of the UK. And the interesting thing was that for about a year, I would close a deal and the client would integrate Braintree, but then integrate one of our competitors as well. And for those who don't know about payments integrations, there is no economies of scale. Like, two integrations is a lot more difficult than one. You need to figure out how the systems talk and all. And at one point, I got really frustrated and started asking clients, like, why are you doing this? Like, this is such a waste of resources. And everyone had their reasons. You know, some wanted to improve acceptance rates because they did a lot of cross-border transactions. Others needed resiliency. You know, they had an outage that cost them hundreds of thousands of euros. So everyone had a different reason, but it was always the same solution. One integration, multiple connections. So we thought if we built an API for this, then any company could do this. And not only, you know, the companies that are processing hundreds of millions of euros and have dev teams of hundreds of engineers. And then we decided to do it in Brazil just because the problem was a lot bigger here. Brazil has the worst acceptance rate in Latin America. It was last time we checked, it was 78%. And merchants here change integrations more often than I change shirts. So they're changing integrations on a yearly basis. So we're like, all right, well, this will solve all those problems.
And why are they doing that? Why are merchants in Brazil using so many different payment processors?
So Brazil is actually a pretty complex payments landscape. Like, if you think about it, we have three payment methods, essentially, right? You have cards, boleto, which is essentially like an invoice. It's actually amazing technology, but thinking that it's been around for 30 years, but it's an invoice that you can pay in any bank or, I don't know how you say Lotérica, but in these different stores and around the country. And then now you have Pix, which is our immediate bank-to-bank transfer. So a lot of times they change to make sure that they have the right payment methods. They change to make sure that the costs, they can decrease their costs. It's 5 to 6x what it costs in the US or Europe to transact. And a lot of times just because the payments providers here don't live up to their promise. You know, monthly downtimes are a thing. The integrations aren't easy. Like I said, you have poor acceptance rates. So they change with the hope that they'll be able to do better.
And is Boleto and Peak, did you say, or PIC? Are those are centrally managed like government programs that interact with the banks?
Yeah, exactly. They're centrally managed payment methods. PIX was released November of 2020, I believe. And its adoption has just been astonishing. It's something that I think you had UPI in India, which was the last mass adoption, and PIX just surpassed them within a few months. Last month, I believe that it surpassed the volume of credit cards online.
Wow, really? And is this privately held company?
No, it's a standard payment method monitored and created by the central bank. The central bank actually did a great job of getting payments experts and payments companies around a table to not only develop the solution, but the documentation and the different phased rollouts. So, you know, people can say a lot about Brazilian banks, but the central bank did a very good job on this one.
Interesting. And it's only Brazil. So you'd have to send money and receive money from people in Brazil.
Yeah. And then the way it works is you can have up to 3 keys for your bank account. And the keys can be your CPF, which is essentially like your government ID number, your telephone, your email. So just with a telephone or email, you can really easily send money from your account, your bank account to my bank account. It's like Venmo, but Venmo, you need to have the app, right? Or Zis. You don't need the app. You just need a bank account.
And to put this in put Brazil in perspective for people, population 212 million in Brazil, and what's the GDP of Brazil? Let's see, by comparison, I think the US is 20 trillion. Brazil is 1.4. So I'd say roughly, US is roughly 15 times the size, and maybe like 50% the population. So big country. It looks like the GDP is growing quickly, although ups and downs. where do you see the, like, how do you, as someone who lives there and is from there, how do you see the Brazilian economy? Is it held back by anything? Is there large obstacles in your way?
And I have an interesting viewpoint because I've been able to live and work in a lot of different economies, right? So US, Europe, and even within Europe, in a few different countries. I think Brazil has a lot of things going for it. The population adopts technology like no other I've ever seen. Pix is a good example of that. But even something like Facebook or WhatsApp, we're the second biggest country. I think Facebook, we're still the second biggest country. Maybe don't quote me on that. But so you have a technology that's, you know, very keen on adopting technology, deep mobile proliferation. But then you also do have the flip side where you have a lot of corruption, increase in inflation. But the interesting thing is that especially as our business is concerned, you do have this move to digital, which was perhaps a bit stagnant before COVID. I mean, just last year, I think the e-commerce industry grew something like 30%. And this is the type of thing that is not only a movement in Brazil, but can actually be a movement that can really just propel the whole region forward. Right? So if you look at Europe, and Europe was also always a great case study for me, because especially working in payments, is because you essentially have a kind of a, like, you have different cultures and different payments habits, but it's essentially homogenous, right? You could use one provider for the whole region, whereas Latin America, you don't even have anything near that. Right? It's still very fragmented, which decreases the possibility of cross-border transactions and trade. And also of money circulating within the industry. So it's something that we're really excited about, not only because of the work we do, but because of how we see the industry growing.
And what's your goal with this company? What do you hope to unlock or hope to achieve?
Yeah, it really is to become the best payments platform in Latin America. And what we hope to achieve is actually to help these merchants, a lot of them, which are startups, digital native technology companies, which don't have proper infrastructure, allow them to focus on their core business. And by doing so, unlock the potential of the region.
And plug, do you go by plug or does it usually say plug pagamentos? I guess payments, just payments in Spanish, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think most people would just call us plug though.
Yeah. Those people great name, plug. By the way. Yeah.
It's obvious.
Yeah. Yeah. I like it a lot. So obviously starting in Brazil, do you view the jump to other countries as being something you can do in the short term, like this year, next year, or is that way down the line?
No. We're doing it within the next few months. So it's nice. It's very short term for us. Essentially, the way we see it, and my career, part of it was actually opening new regions and new markets for tech companies. So the way I see it is we actually don't have any financial regulation that inhibits us from opening new markets. We just need providers that allow for local processing. So we're working on those integrations now, and we hope to open up a few markets this year still. And then this year, eventually have pods of people to support the local operations. So sales, support, success, and engineering.
Hmm. And what were you doing before that? You were working for Braintree, opening up new markets. Were you physically going to these countries to take meetings, or what were you doing before?
Exactly. Yeah. So would not only work on closing customers in those different regions, but also even doing things like creating content for that region, understanding what were the local hurdles to actually closing deals. And before Braintree, I would do this for a company called Shoot as well. So I opened the East Coast operations. Shoot was YC Winner 12. Opened the East Coast operations out of New York, and then opened the European operations out of London. So I've always had a bit of this nomadic business appeal.
You're like the nomadic business payments guy.
It's like everyone's talking about, you know, being a digital nomad. I was like, I've done that for 7 years. I'm okay with that. I like having roots now.
Yeah. It is. It can be draining if you do it too long, for sure.
Yeah, well, you just moved, and I'm sure that was, how was that?
Yeah, I was draining. I'm done moving.
Yeah.
Especially moving around. There's time and place for it, for sure. Like living abroad, traveling abroad. But, you know, like anything, when you get older and family, or you have a place that you're like, I'm good for here, travel around, it will. But how do you open new branches? So Shoot hires you, or Braintree hires you. What's your playbook? You land in a new place and you say, do you spend a week like reading the regulatory website, or do you punch up a... What's your playbook?
So I can tell you my playbook now, but I can tell you that when I opened the other regions, I didn't have a playbook. I was very much, you know, learning on the go, made tons of mistakes, learned from those mistakes. But the most interesting thing is what I would do nowadays, what I recommend people do is actually understand, especially if they're working in the sales role, is actually understand the buying cultures. Like one thing that someone told me was that if you're in a meeting with an English buyer and they say, oh, that's interesting, they're never going to buy. They're just being polite, right? You know, you can just close the laptop and be like, all right, you know, enjoy your tea, I'm out. And I think it's like that in a lot of cultures, like Brazilians, like they'll tell you they love your solution, that you're solving a real problem, you know, you should come over and have coffee with me and meet my family. But that doesn't mean they want to buy. Like Brazilians are just excessively friendly too. So nowadays my playbook is, first of all, study the buying culture there, understand what are the signals, how do we actually project those signals, and then never try to do anything alone, right? Local partners, local knowledge is invaluable, especially in the early days when you're making mistakes, even basic mistakes like around language, that will turn a lot of people off, which is why I like the pod. You know, you have a little self-sustaining pod that can work a region. Since I didn't have a pod, I was kind of a lone wolf opening these markets. I really came to value that after I did. Not only was the degree of stress just infinitely lower, but just productivity was a lot better as well.
And the pod meaning a few people, like 3, 4, 5 people that live in the culture or live in the country and have been there for a long time and understand it?
Well, not everyone has to have lived there for a long time and understand it, but they need to have different roles. They need to have different roles so that they can support the different necessary functions of the business. It's not the same thing if you put, you know, 4 people where one's a solutions engineer, one's a customer success person, and one's a salesperson. And if you, it's not the same to do that versus 3 salespeople. Like the pod will be more effective in the long run, in my opinion. And I think it also depends on the business. Like I'm used to selling complex solutions. If, I don't know, if I had maybe one of those last mile delivery companies, maybe I probably would just, you know, have a bunch of salespeople that are just very aggressive and knocking on every door and getting and onboarding as many customers as possible.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And are you still, do you see companies change that strategy of needing to physically be in the country, given so much is remote now? I imagine you were there physically because you were taking meetings in person.
Right. So no, they don't need to be there physically to do meetings. It does help to be there physically to kind of, especially to get the, to know the payments culture. I'm talking about my business, to know the payments culture. How do people buy? What do people buy? That sort of thing. It's very hard to come by online. Like even things like how do people use mobile? It's something that I think is always very interesting, especially when we're thinking about delivering the best payments experience, not only for the merchants, but for their customers as well. It's something that allows us to do a bit of research and development that I wouldn't be able to do even if I spent 9 hours on Zoom speaking to someone from Mexico, right?
Mm, yeah. And so are you living in Brazil now for this business, or where is home for you?
Home is Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. And that's one thing that's amazing. I love Rio. I've always loved Rio. I love the lifestyle here. I mean, we're talking about this earlier, like, you know, Oregon and Portland. There's a lot of nature, Rio as well. It's like a city just surrounded and embraced by nature. A lot of people thought that we'd have to open in São Paulo, and we do spend a lot of time in São Paulo, but Rio is home.
Why São Paulo? What's the difference between the two? Or why would you have to open there?
It's the metropolis. I think it's like the biggest metropolis in Latin America. Probably the highest density of tech companies. And our customers are digital native, you know, tech first companies. So that's where they are. So not many people, like in-person meetings are happening again. But a lot of people are still just prefer to have a Zoom call and work from home. So
broke yeah. Like that. Yeah. Yeah, it makes sense. And you went through YC, right? So was that entirely remote when YC 2021, right? Last year?
Yeah. Yeah. We were the second remote batch. We may have been the first remote batch, and then like one batch was, no, we were the second remote batch. Don't quote me on that either. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But yeah, it was an interesting experience. Like, I don't know how I would have done that many meetings if I hadn't been remote. That's exactly what I think about all the time. Like when we were building, when we were selling, when we were fundraising, I have no idea how they did it when they were in person. I'm pretty sure people didn't shower. Like they need to skip some of the basic elements of life.
I mean, you just run around San Francisco. I mean, I've done that twice, and you just run around San Francisco in an Uber, like back to back, and try to take as many meetings as possible.
You were living in LA at the time.
LA and SF. I lived in SF for one of those fundraising. But LA, yeah. I mean, you hop on a plane and you just go up there and then take a bunch of meetings, I would say, I don't know where we are today with that, but still, it's good to do for like final meetings, or if you're raising a lot of money, like a, you know, 20, 30 plus million, then it's like, why not do it? But
there is something to be said about that.
Mm-hmm.
Like the personal connection you can develop if you just get to spend more time with someone, if you see like their little habits, how they treat, you know, the valet person, like some stuff like that. I think there's a lot that you can like garner from little interactions that will ultimately show how you, this person might be to deal with in the long run. We got really lucky with our investors, but you have a lot of horror stories.
And you went through the application process was all remote too, right? On YC? So
yes.
Yeah.
That was nervous.
What do you think hooked them?
What do I think hooked them? It's a great question because we got denied the first time because our CTO wasn't full-time at the time. And then the second time, I think we're the only company that I know of that had like three or four rounds of interviews the second time. I've heard of companies having two, we had three or four. I think what hooked them was first that we're payments experts. Like the whole team, we work for payments companies. We like to say that this is a solution that I wanted to sell, that Marcel, our CTO, wanted to build, and that Thiago, our CEO, wanted to integrate because he was on the client side. And not only that, but you had this massive market with a huge problem. You had the worst acceptance rate in Latin America. You had costs that were 5 or 6x what they are in the US or Europe. And then you had merchants changing their integrations on an annual basis, which is absolutely nuts. So I think the combination of team with a very ambitious goal and the right background plus a big problem, you know, maybe these guys won't be able to solve the problem, but if anyone were to, I think like they'd be a good bet.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Team, market size, and then the general condition of the market. When you say the acceptance rate, does the acceptance rate refer to the number of attempts to make a transaction, or what is the acceptance rate when you say that's very low?
So out of 100 transactions, 78 will fail, or 78 will be accepted, 22 will fail.
Wow.
If I were to try to win a merchant in Europe saying like, I have a 78% acceptance rate, like I would be laughed out the door. Like we're talking about mid to high 90s there. And it always depends how you cut it. Like some people leave, you know, transactions denied by fraud providers in there. Some people remove that. But no matter which way you cut it, 78% is way, way low.
And that's...
Here, it's just like the cost of doing business.
Wow. What is that? That's 22% of people that are just genuinely trying to purchase something in Brazil from a merchant in Brazil and being denied?
Yeah. Exactly. And you have a variety of reasons for denial, right? You have the issuing banks that may deny it. You have fraud providers that's like, okay, well, you know, this information wasn't provided or this isn't similar to other purchasing patterns. But we see with retries, we can actually improve the acceptance rate and with routing to the right providers as well. One of the most bizarre ones that we noticed early on was that insufficient funds. Insufficient funds seems like it's binary, right? Either you do have enough funds or you don't. But for whatever reason, the issuing banks assign insufficient funds to a lot of transactions they decline. And then when we retry them, a third of them are approved.
Why would that be? Why were they denied in the first place?
Yeah, so that's a good question. And this is hearsay. I want to be very clear that I'm not stating a fact here, but this is sort of like payments lore that apparently the schemes they have certain limits of what error codes you can ascribe, because at the end of the day, the issuing banks, they have this very just awful job that they either approve or deny the transactions. And if they approve a fraudulent transaction, then they actually are stuck with the bill. They need to refund the money if there's a chargeback, and they, the net loss is theirs. So the burden's on them. And then if they, for all intents and purposes, they could really just be like, all right, anything that looks risky, we're going to deny. But the schemes don't allow them to deny for generic reasons. Like you have a limit as to how many transactions you can deny per reason. And then like, once again, this is what I heard. I'm not saying it's a fact, but so after the generic decline, the second one that they use the most is insufficient funds.
Interesting.
And the most interesting thing is that as a merchant, you actually can't tell the customer like, hey, your card has insufficient funds. There's some rule between the issuing banks and the schemes, I believe, that doesn't allow you to give that specific information. So they'll say you have to get in touch with your bank.
Really? Even though the merchant will know, it'll say on the screen, denied for insufficient funds. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really strange.
Bizarre.
But is it the way the incentive structure, is it that in Brazil, the banks are responsible, where in other parts of the world, they're not responsible? Because I'm still trying to wrap my head around why, like what's structurally miscalibrated?
I mean, I think you do have to account just for Brazilians. Like Brazilians are like, it's like we have PhD programs in fraud. So right there, I'm not saying like this is just like, oh, you know, Brazilian issuing banks. And no, like you do have a very adverse scenario here where you have a consumer base that's new to credit, new to cards, that have historically bought a lot on installments. So it's a population base that's used to getting sort of indebted through these installments. So I think it's adverse conditions and then just a risk appetite because of these adverse conditions. Like in terms of the PhD in fraud, yeah. Mexico's pretty close. So
why is that? Why do you think there's such a strong pervasive cultural difference in fraud between, I mean, I don't sense that in the US. It doesn't feel like people are PhD in fraud. Is there some undercurrent or some reason for that?
I don't know. I think that just ingenuity. Yeah. That's what I have to
say. I mean, in a way, it's a form of innovation and hustle. You know,
it is
the one perspective on it. cross border. What would you guess if you have any idea as to the percentage of transactions in Brazil that are across border? So people. I imagine the most common is remote, right? People purchasing something from a company that's based in another country versus, you know, buying a chimichanga down the street. It's like, if you're doing it online, there's a good chance it's across border, right?
No. So a lot of, and I, just to make sure I understand the question, when you talk about cross border, you mean Brazilians purchasing, you think that the majority of the purchases will be from companies that are abroad?
I would suspect, well, my question is, if I open up a company here in the US and I want to sell something, a piece of software to a Brazilian person in Brazil, does the acceptance rate of 78% still hold? Or in that case,
no, it's even
just
lower.
Using credit card? Really?
Yeah, no, the acceptance rate there is even lower. And there's a variety of things that you can actually do to mitigate this. First is make sure you use the right providers that can accept the currencies. I know that sounds super basic, but a lot of times, you know, people choose providers that can't accept those currencies. So then what will happen is you'll either have to convert and then the FX will be another like 6 or 7% on top of the transaction, or the transaction will be declined. But you don't have a lot of, I would say maybe for software, like you said software. So I think maybe for software, you do have a lot of cross-border transactions, but you don't have a lot of product-based cross-border transactions just because of import tariffs. It's prohibitively expensive and just bureaucratic to actually bring those in.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of a shame, right? Because it feels to me like everyone wins or... most people win. You want tariffs to be as low as possible. You want trade to happen as much as possible. Granted, there are edge cases where you have a nation's either security or data privacy at large. Like, you know, you want to be able to manufacture some of the things that are critical for the economy. But that's not the majority of stuff. The majority of stuff is like, when I think about what I purchase, clothing, it's like electronics. And if you have a country where you have huge import tariffs, you're blocking people from being able to trade with other countries that are making those things. Is that not something that people are Do you feel like people culturally kind of just kind of shrug their shoulders and say, oh, well, that's just Brazil? Or is there pressure to change that?
I don't think there's pressure to change that. I think it's more, it's just the way we're used to doing things, right? Someone travels abroad, they're like, hey, can you bring me an iPhone just because it's cheaper there? Like, I think it's just part of the culture, but obviously everyone, wish that weren't the case.
Yeah, makes sense.
I don't even know what would be done.
Yeah. Well, you could lower the import tariffs. You say cut them by 80%. And then all of a sudden, if that happened, then all of a sudden the companies in the US and other places would want to sell to people in Brazil. Yeah. And then that would happen back and forth.
But I'm sure I'm sure there's plenty of gatekeepers that won't want that to happen. Like for a while, Brazil had the most expensive iPod and iPhone in the world, right? Like if you looked at, how they have that Big Mac index? Like if you looked at the iPod index, Brazil is the most expensive.
Really? What are people using for the most part? Are people just buying it, but just sucking it up and buying iPhones and expensive phones? Or
I mean, I doubt that the majority of the population uses iPhones. Like you have less expensive options for smartphones, but smartphone penetration here is really high. So,
yeah, good. Well, I hope it is. on the product roadmap, you guys raised a few million. How big is the team now?
So we are 25 now.
Wow. And are they all in Brazil or South America or all over the place?
Currently someone's in Peru, but she's in Peru just for family reasons. But but everyone else is in Brazil. We're fully remote and just a big mixing pot of Brazilian local cultures, which is kind of nice because you have the different accents and, what do you call this? What do you call that? So I think we really enjoy that mix.
That's cool. And do people speak Portuguese or English on the calls?
Good question. For the most part, Portuguese on the calls. However, a lot of our, given that we have international investors and that we do have expansion plans, a lot of our internal documentation is written in English to make sure, just more for prosperity, so people can read it and understand it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And so generally the playbook is, hey, let's go sell this integration, this API into e-commerce companies or companies that have a digital payment method. And then on the backside, we allow other payment methods like Braintree or PayPal or whatever, Stripe, to integrate into our backend so that they only integrate once. And then you're kind of the pipe between those two. Is that the right way to think about it?
Yeah, I would say that on the sales side, like the payments problem in Brazil is really big, right? So usually companies find us. So it's like, hey, we heard about you from a customer or from a friend or from a developer. And we kind of get to know what their problem is. And usually we can pair them up with a few solutions that make sense. And then all the solutions are served through our single API. So for them, it's kind of the comfort, like, all right, I'm going to integrate once, and then I have just to deal with these people that are payments experts, they can handle all the bureaucracy with the other providers. And then once they're integrated and running, they can change, like this without having to integrate, without having to write any code.
Mm. And you guys would have done the work on the back end.
Yeah, we integrate everybody and then we abstract that complexity. So we'll integrate the Stripes, the Adyens, the Braintrees, the Cielos, the PagSeguros, banks, fraud providers. And then you can build your payments infrastructure modularly with everyone that we have integrated.
Mm. What about other countries in South America? We were chatting earlier about the idea of in Europe, people can send money across borders. There's more of a standard protocol for payments. In South America, that's not the case. There is no South America equivalent of the euro, right? It's independent currencies and... I haven't heard anybody talk about that, but would you be in support of that?
That's interesting. Would I be in support of that? I don't know. I'm like, I'll caveat this by saying I'm no economist, and actually very far from it, but I think the way my monkey mind works is, yeah, I think of all the South American currencies, Brazil probably has one of the strongest. That's not saying much, but, you know, we're saying within this limited scope. So I don't know. I'd have to understand it a little bit better. I think that there are trade agreements within the region, and that might be a start. But having one culture, or one culture, not one currency, I don't know how I feel about that.
Yeah,
would definitely make things easier in the payments landscape. Like, I would love that for the payments landscape. Actually, no, even for the payments landscape, I wouldn't like it, because then it's abstracting a lot of that complexity that's our job. Like, that's our dirty
work,
right? So it removes a lot of the value we provide. Now, we're happy doing the dirty work.
Yeah. No, as long as the problem exists, you guys are, it should be the one to solve it. Do you think it would, like, would these countries reasonably trade with each other? I don't know the history.
Yeah.
I forget.
No.
I don't know if you would know this, but yeah, do you think they would, that there would be a lot more trade going on?
Yeah, no, I definitely, and cross-border trade has, or cross-border purchases have been increasing within local Latin American countries over the past few years. So I definitely think that's still not only possible, but will continue to increase. It was such a small percentage before that. The last time I checked, it was like exponentially growing. So it's like 20-30% every year. And these are transactions that are really problematic. So we love them.
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty interesting. So yeah, when I think about South America, there's a lot of countries, you know, there's a lot of countries that are smaller.
Like
I think of Chile, or what else would be a smaller one? Uruguay might be a little bit bigger, but sometimes there's only really one major city in an area. I think Uruguay is like that, where it's like one dominated metropolitan area, and that's basically the country. I'm curious, do you have a sense of whether people across borders in other countries feel a kind of unity together, or whether it's really they just associate with being like, I'm Argentinian, or I'm from Chile, or Brazil?
You chose, the first example you chose, of a very, very proud nation, the
Argentina.
Yeah, right. So they definitely identify as, we're Argentina.
Yeah.
I think if you go, it's a hard question. I don't know. And I'm definitely, and just to give you a little context, I think within the landscape of Latin America, South America, Brazil kind of stands out as, you know, one of the few ones that not only are we the biggest, but, you know, we also have our own language, Brazilian Portuguese, that, you know, most of the region speaks Spanish. Unless you like go to like French Guiana, then they don't. But then there are a few other examples like that. So I don't know if I have the best perspective here, but the way I see it is Central America, you do have more, not of a homogenous culture, but I think that they're more related, or they don't have as big as differences as you'd say, like Brazil and Argentina, which are rivals, or, you know, other countries that may have some historic tension.
Yeah. At least in football, or soccer.
Yeah.
How about crypto? El Salvador made crypto, Bitcoin, the recognized currency in that country. Do you see, maybe anecdotally, people getting really excited or ignoring crypto? Where do you think the opportunity is for Brazil?
Anecdotally, definitely. You do have, and I believe that the first crypto index fund was listed was actually a Brazilian crypto index fund. I believe it was the first. I'm pretty sure they're the founders and investor of ours. So I think, like, anecdotally, you definitely do see it. The way we see it in our business is that there's still a lot of volatility, and a lot of people use crypto either as a safeguard or as an investment. So they're not actually using it as tender to make purchases, which is what interests us. Like, we don't have any interest in integrating with networks and wallets to be able for you to just transfer your crypto assets. For us, it'd be interesting if you could use that, or if merchants wanted to accept that crypto asset and people wanted to use it as well. I think that's where we would be keen. And it's just not there yet. But I do think I'm bullish on it. I do think that people will begin using crypto as payment methods for, you know, things other than virtual digital goods.
Why isn't it there? Is it that the merchants aren't asking you to integrate crypto payment methods, yeah, or more consumers? The reason that the merchants aren't asking is because the consumers aren't asking the merchants.
And this is anecdotal as well, but if I'm a merchant and I sell something, you know, that's worth $10 today and then tomorrow it's worth 20, great. But if I sell it, then it's worth 10 today and then tomorrow it's worth 5 or 0, you know, that may not be a very predictable business. So I think the volatility is kind of what still gets it. And you know, a lot of people don't understand, like we were talking in the beginning, I think before we started recording, about security, right? You know, how secure is a merchant's wallet? Who's going to be doing that security? For better or worse, they know that, you know, when you process a transaction with a credit card or with Pix, like your bank has it, right? Your bank has it and you know where to get it.
Yeah, you could get around the volatility issue by using a stable currency. Sure. Even Bitcoin is not, it's not crazy in volatile anymore. But your point's valid, right? People have a concern over the volatility, maybe getting in and out of crypto. But it seems to me like it has to, if it doesn't, if you're not smelling any indication of that happening in Brazil, because you're kind of at the tip of the spear, right? You're like, built, you went through YC, building an innovative payment company in Brazil, which is a large market, and you're reporting, hey, merchants don't really care, right? Like, that's your...
Here, there's two things there, right? First, there's that saying that there are weeks that happen in decades, and there are decades that happen in weeks. So this could be the type of shift that we see really quickly. And second, you know, we have a tendency to relate things to what we know, right? So we know how we use money, how we use tender, and we want to relate, you know, crypto because it does have, you know, similar values and properties. We want to equate it to the same use case here. Whereas what I've seen, you know, from, like you said, from the vantage point that I have, is that there's just a lot of other ways that, companies being born now are actually seeing that are more interesting, that aggregate more value, either to contracts. We actually spoke to one recently that's building trust funds for crypto. So perhaps it's just the use case isn't the one that we're used to.
Mm. That makes sense. The use case isn't the one you're used to. So crypto being used for transactions is different.
It might be.
Yeah. I haven't looked. I'm sure this is readily available, but does Brazil experience inflation the way, like, Argentina has nasty inflation? Is Brazil's pretty rough too?
I would say it's not as bad as Argentina's, but Brazil isn't great either.
Yeah. Yeah. You've lived all over, man. You've lived in London, Madrid, New York, San Francisco. Where did you see, and you've been in payments during these times, is there a country that stands out to you as having figured out better ways to facilitate trade? Like, does Spain have a system, or is every country just independently kind of doing their own thing on payments? I mean, Brazil seems to be.
So Brazil does stand out just because it has synchronous payment methods, that asynchronous payment methods, you know, it's got online, offline payment methods. Mm-hmm. So I think it has installments, it has advancements on receivables. So a transaction that in the US, you process a credit card transaction, you'll receive it in 2 to 3 days. Here, you'll receive it in 30 days, right? And that's from the era of hyperinflation, which doesn't make sense anymore, but, you know, it's a good way for these companies to make money. But one of the ones that I always thought was super curious, and when I heard about it, I called friends that lived there and I asked, like, wait, do you guys actually do this? Is a Germany that does cash on delivery. Like, that sounds like a nightmare for me. Like, someone coming to my house to deliver something, and I actually need to be there to pick it up, and they just can't, like, throw it in a box or, like, in a mail slot. And then second, it's like, they ring my doorbell. It's like, okay, wait, I need to find cash. And then, like, we sit there, it's, you know, 29:30, and I'm giving you coins or you're giving me coins. That sounds like a nightmare, but people still do use it. It's like pretty prevalent.
Cash on demand.
Cash on delivery.
Cash on delivery.
Yeah.
That is wild. Yeah. Yeah. Is cash still a big part of the economy in Brazil?
It's anecdotal as well, but it's decreasing rapidly with Pix. Like, you have flanelians, which are people that, you know, they'll give you a little ticket so you can park your car on the street. And then you would pay them with like 2 reais or 3 reais or something like that. Now all these people accept Pix. And then you have the, I don't think the word is the unofficial economy, but yeah, it's the unofficial economy where people selling, you know, food on the beach or stuff like that, like all of them accept Pix nowadays. It's really kind of impressive. Even what do you call people that ask for money on the streets?
A beggar?
Sure.
I thought there was a performer.
Yeah, like performers or even people living on the streets. They ask for money, and a lot of them have Pix now that you can just, you know, electronically wire them money.
That is impressive. What is it called? PIX is how you spell it?
PIX. Yeah.
Pix, man, that's pretty wild. That is so, it's an electronic method, so pervasive. What else about Brazil do you think most people don't appreciate or most people don't understand how it's different than, say, from the U.S.?
I think one thing that I always thought was really interesting was we read a case study about Brazilian executives abroad. And this was a few years back, and most people don't realize how incredibly adverse the business scenario here can be. And, you know, it's one thing to start a company and then you're venture backed, like that's all good. And yes, it's very hard. It's by far the hardest job I've ever had. But at the same time, the people that do it without venture backing, people that do it bootstrapped or just like have, you know, not hyper growth companies that they open, I think it's bizarre the amount of bureaucracy that you need to go through and how challenging it can be to actually have a successful business here. Whereas in the US, I think it's very entrepreneurial and entrepreneurially friendly and almost like a dream scenario where even like the, you know, limited liability corporation, I think even that, yeah, it's just like tremendously facilitated and ingrained that culture, which, you know, I thoroughly appreciate. And I wish that Brazil moved more in that direction.
Huh. So just starting a company takes a lot of, what is it, time and filing paperwork?
Yeah.
Brazil? Like if I start a company here, I could have a company in 15 minutes by just going to the, yeah.
You could have a company faster than we did this podcast. And the funny thing is like, yeah, so starting a company is an enormous amount of time and effort and paperwork. Closing down a company is can be even more so. Like there's some people like, well, it's just less expensive to leave this company open. So let's forget about it. And there it is.
Wow.
Yeah, it's
kind of surprising.
Bureaucracy.
It would seem like,
oh no,
who wins? Like the government doesn't win there, right? I mean, the government has no incentive to slow down entrepreneurs. Like it.
I mean, I think they think they win.
Yeah, how? I mean, what would be like? Best case scenario. Like play a steel man. Why does the politician not want more entrepreneurs and businesses?
Right. It's not that they don't want it. It's that they want their cut as well. And by the way, this is me. This is my opinion.
Between me and you.
The same thing we're talking about tariffs. Right? This is between me and you and all my listeners. it's the same thing we're talking about tariffs, right? Like who wins from having these really high tariffs? Like they surely would win by, you know, by moving the economy more. And I think it's a similar thing that they just have these outdated bureaucracy and outdated processes. You have a lot of gatekeepers and everyone thinks that they need to rubber stamp it and that they want their piece as well. That's the way I see it. And it's a very simplistic way to see it. And I'm not saying that I have any answers or would even like to think about answers in that space. But when you ask about differences in the US and Brazil,
you got answers for sure. I mean, one answer is make it easy to start a company. Make it so there's one standardized form. It costs $100 and you can have it done in 20 minutes. Like, there's the North Star. Like, Brazil, you can accomplish that. Listen, you're right. All right, let's put it in perspective. You are in Brazil. You're Rio. You're a super smart guy. You're young. You started a company that's high growth. You went through YC, which is the most reputable investment firm on the planet, right? So talk about credibility. You've focused on payments and you've traveled around the world. So you have a perspective of the world and it's in a respected industry that you're actually talking about in payments. If you, I mean, you have to be the one, not you are going to, you know, do this, but to articulate your opinion about the direction that Brazil should go in this specific area, I think is, if you don't do it, who else will? Like, nothing. I mean, we'll be 30 years from now, I'll have another podcast and we're like, oh God, it takes way too long, costs way too much to start companies in Brazil. Like, you know, I don't know, man, I'd encourage you, like, you know, write an article or send it. I don't know what the next step is. But I know that you have a lot more influence than you probably give yourself credit for. And I think, politicians can.
I would have you as my hype man any day, Mike.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll just use exactly that as like my ringtone or something or when I need a conversation. But I think like ultimately it doesn't come down to rationale. It comes down to politics. Right. And I'm terrible at politics, actually.
Well, the only difference between
politics,
the only difference between politics and rational decision-making is the vague of ambiguity. That's the space between those two. So politicians can make decisions that benefit themselves, and the separation between what benefits themselves and what benefits their constituents, the distance between there is corruption, and the space between there shrinks when people understand the impacts and the complexity of decisions. Like, if your average person on the street in America could say, like, hey, yeah, I think it's a really great idea that we have really low costs to start businesses, because the more businesses that people start, the more economy that's driven, the more people are adding value. If they can articulate that story, and that's a story that people understand and believe, politicians they'll just line up to that. The politicians only do what people want. And so the game, of course, is like, how do you teach people? How do you articulate that message? And we're in a space now where 2022, you know, you can spread ideas virtually for free, hence on this podcast. So
yeah,
I think things can change a lot quicker today than they could 5-10 years ago, even.
If you need a catalyst, like right now, people want Carnival. Like they've been out kind of for 2 years. Like they don't want simplified.
You need to go down there.
I get it.
Go down there with a big sign that says, we need to decrease our costs to start businesses.
Yeah. Turn off the music. Stop playing.
Yeah.
Let me tell you. I'll be super well received.
That's hilarious to even think about. If you do that, you know what you could do? I bet if you did that and put it on social media, it would go viral. Hey guys, I gotta explain.
I'm not sure that's. I don't want to go viral for that. I think
that'd be so funny. If you went down, you say, "Hey,
focus
girls,
on solving the payments problems."
Turn down your volume on this music. I have to explain this payments app I built.
Yeah,
I had a good time with you, Alex. Do you write publicly? Are you on Twitter or any social media you want to throw out there?
I am on Twitter. I'm more of a viewer than a poster. But it's EL Villena. That's my handle. I write a lot privately, but lately I've been thinking about doing it more publicly. So
who knows
after this podcast and your hype, I'll do so.
Dude, do it. Push the publish button. And the site is plugpagamentos.com. Congrats on everything you're doing, man. Hope to have you back on one day. Keep crushing it.
Yeah, no, Mike, thank you. This was super enjoyable and appreciate all the questions.
All right, buddy. I'll talk soon.
All right.
Thank you for listening to Around the Coin. If you enjoyed the show today, consider giving us a quick review wherever you listen to podcasts, tweet about it, or text it to a friend. We really appreciate all the support and growing that we can. If you have any guests you'd like us to bring on or feedback for us, don't hesitate to reach out. We would love to hear from you.
This is a Glassbox Media Podcast.